is the Perpetual Notion Machine, and I'm your host, Kelly Schwartz. American academic research institutions are some of the most prestigious in the world. Investments in science and technology have helped the U.S. to emerge as an economic and philanthropic world leader. However, the partial current government shutdown has brought many aspects of academic research to a halt. With so many other aspects of life impacted by the shutdown, why should listeners fret for the current and future funding of scientific ventures? To explore this topic more tonight, I'm joined by two fellow research academics to discuss this very prudent topic of the national conversation. I am joined tonight by Matthew Blackburn, a second-year biochemistry graduate student in the lab of Dr. Michael Sussman, who studies hormone signaling in plants, and Josh Mitchell, who is a second-year biochemistry graduate student in the lab of Dr. Dean Mosher, who studies cell biology of eosinophils, which are a type of white blood cell. We were trying to figure out a really convenient way to explain what that is, so think of it as white blood cells. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So, to kind of get this started, tonight's topic is going to sort of center around this idea of why should Americans care about science's lapsed funding during and after the government shutdown. So we can probably talk a little bit first about, in case listeners aren't familiar with the federal science funding structure. Does anybody care to kind of take a stab at that?
I could speak a little bit to how NIH funding works.
So people know, we're going to be talking about two of the main funding programs, or agencies, I guess, of the federal government. So there's NIH, which is the National Institute of Health, which is primarily concerned with medical research, biotechnology, things like that. And then the National Science Foundation, which funds what's considered to be more basic research, agricultural research, some things like that. Just sort of simply, if we start talking about those two.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll jump in on NIH funding structure. Generally, the way academic science works is that a research lab will propose a type of project. And in order to pay for the expenses of technology development, stipends for the working scientists, et cetera, they will make a proposal and submit this to NIH. And there are a variety of grants available. For grad students, you get F-35s. You also get training grants. For a matured lab, a well-established lab, you can get other types of grants that actually, I don't know all of these off the top of my head, but the most important of which that everyone tries to get is the R01.
That's the big one. That's the big money. Yeah.
And essentially, it's important to reiterate that labs in and of themselves cannot pay for their own research because it is original technology development in addition to paying for people to do this work. So it's quite expensive. And for this, external funding is required. And that is essentially why the NIH and its current grant structures exist. Josh, I guess, would you like to talk about NSF?
That, honestly, Matt, I think you got it covered best. You know the funding structure way better than I do.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Well, NSF is... Kelly may actually know more than both of us.
Oh, no, no. I've been mostly NIH funded for most of my time.
As life scientists, I guess it will suffice for me to say that the NSF is essentially everything non-medical that is more technology development. In my own lab, as Kelly mentioned, I do plant research. That is something that would not be within the purview of the National Institutes of Health as such. But that said, plant research has important implications for such things as agricultural development, food security, the development of novel compounds, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of get back to the idea of the shutdown and how this is impacted, it's worth noting that NIH grants, NIH funding is not impacted by the shutdown. That is an agency that already has appropriations for the fiscal year 2019. Agencies who are whose appropriations have not passed yet include the Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, Homeland Security, Housing and Urban Development, Interior, Justice, State, Transportation, Treasury, Environmental Protection Agency, National Aeronautics and Space, which is NASA, the National Science Foundation, which is NSF, National Endowment for the Arts, and National Endowment for Humanities. So all of those programs are impacted by the shutdown. So has your lab specifically, as an NSF-funded lab, been impacted?
So far, we are actually between grant renewals. So we have a gap in funding, but that's purely on a cyclical basis. I think we are actually lucky for the timing because we are affected for a different reason in terms of our funding. But had this shutdown occurred earlier or later, this would become problematic for us. Sure. And it would make it harder for us to dip into that honeypot. If you like.
Who doesn't like a honeypot? Right. Yeah. And like honeypots, you can get trapped by funding if you don't have, you know, once you got the honeypot. So what would this mean in terms of day-to-day operations? I've read stories about graduate students funded by NSF grants who are not getting paid, but are still maybe coming in and doing their dissertation work anyway, because it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition where you are paid as a government, you know, through these government grants, you are somewhat of a federal employee. You're somewhat of an employee of the university as well, but you're also a student. So you also have academic responsibilities in addition to this funding that you receive. So I know that some people have had problems sort of reconciling, do I go into work? I'm not getting paid. There's collaborations, there's research that, you know, certain students can't even get to, or if they require access to a specific national database or an email server that has critical data, they're unable to access that because it's been locked down because of the shutdown. Yep.
Sure. So sure. Certainly, especially with large grants like this, which span multiple years. And it depends on the grant itself. But generally, you have to be able to prove your merit year over year for continued funding. So you may be awarded, for example, a grant lasting 3 years. But that doesn't mean you are guaranteed money for 3 years. You need to prove that you are achieving the aims of your proposed research in a timely enough manner to justify maintaining the public trust in the quality of your research, justifying the fact that they are paying for you to do this.
Sure.
So if you do encounter an interruption in funding, that will indeed impact your ability to achieve those aims. As you mentioned, certain databases may go down. This certainly depends on your research. You may or may not require highly specialized databases. You may be in the production of a particular database that is very niche to your research, but is nevertheless important. And if you don't have enough funding externally to keep up that work, you won't be able to pursue that. And certainly, as to students coming in and doing their work, even though they're not being paid, it's tricky for a student, I think, maybe also for postdocs and staff scientists, maybe less for staff scientists, but it's kind of almost like show business. Like the science has to go on, the show has to go on.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not that it's a lifestyle per se, but the work sort of dies if it loses its pace. And it's really keeping up that pace and keeping priorities straight. And that's why I think a lot of people are still biting that bullet and going in to do work.
Yeah, I just feel so bad for people that are kind of caught in the crosshairs of this. You know, certainly students are largely innocent of whatever is going on at the national level, at the policy level. They are, you know, like humans and workers and people with dreams that hope to get by whatever means. So I do want to bring the conversation kind of back around to where we started with this. We kind of came around to discussing this idea based on an article written by Marshall Shepard for Forbes and on the 5th of January called Debunking the Myth of Wasted Science Investment. And it was sort of about, he was kind of talking about how as a meteorologist, as like an academic meteorologist, that he wouldn't be able to attend this, that a lot of eminent scientists weren't able to attend a national conference, right? So this funding pays for transportation, it pays for lodging, it pays for a number of things. Also, you know, if you don't have your poster printed yet, you may not be able to actually get your data. So why does that matter that these scientists can't attend a conference? And on his Twitter, he was talking about how he kind of got some bullying remarks from people, you know, saying like, good, well, the U.S. is saving money by not sending these scientists to these conventions. What good is that anyway? And I mean, I think it's a worthwhile question to ask, you know, what does the U.S. lose when science is shut down, when the funding of science is shut down?
And I think one of the issues is it's really easy to separate science out from, in many ways, the rest of the economic environment. You know, science, it runs much like a company. I think it's easy to lose track of that if you're not going to conferences, that's missing out on conference calls. If mm-hmm. you shut down your work, your lab, that's shutting down a factory. Mm-hmm. But it's also on a different scale because since science is so continuous, if you miss an opportunity, if you miss a day or a couple of days, that gap in time isn't an immediate stop like a factory where you can mm-hmm. halt production. During that time, you may have experiments, you may have living organisms that are continuing mm-hmm. to develop and grow. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just very easy for the public to separate out how exactly does this tie in? You know, mm-hmm. what is science and what is it like? And if you're not necessarily in it, it's easy to lose sight of that. Would you agree with that, Matt?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's certainly one of those fields where, well, this is really true of every field that has any kind of specialized focus, but you really don't know and aren't equipped to compare it or make judgments about it until you've at least dipped your toes in it mm-hmm. and seen kind of how things work under the hood. And I think it's important to emphasize, too, that conferences in particular are the blood of science. You cannot achieve good coherent science mm-hmm. without communicating those results, and you cannot get yeah. those results validated, which is to say tested by independent parties, without telling them about the results in the first place. Mm-hmm. So science is really dead in the water without communication, and communication, the easiest way to do this is at conferences
yeah.
where multiple yeah. people from across the US and indeed across the world take a week to talk and compare ideas and show, you know, what novel technologies they've developed.
Yeah, this is the community. This is, like you said, this is the gathering of the masses in order to share information one place, one time. And you get a lot of collaborations out of it. When I was searching for postdocs, that was how I found postdocs, was just talking to, you know, people that had labs at conferences and saying, you know, hey, you need some help. It makes jobs. It also, you know, brings money to the cities or the universities where this is being held. I mean, it's also a mm-hmm. somewhat of an academic or an economic as well as academic force.
And this yeah. is actually interesting. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Josh.
Oh, no,
I'll take 2 seconds. But so this is something that I only learned recently, but the major publishing groups actually frequent conferences as well. Mm-hmm. That part was not Ooh. New to me, but they go specifically to... it's almost like talent scouting. They look for what they like to call the next thought leaders in a particular field. Mm-hmm. And these are people whose labs they want to recruit, if you like, to their journal, and even potentially as reviewers. Mm-hmm. I should mention reviewing in science, reviews of the literature are done largely voluntarily. Other labs are invited to peer review mm-hmm. the work of that is being submitted
right.
into a journal. And we do not, as scientists, get directly compensated for that. That is just an unspoken duty of science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that, again, like you said, it's something that maybe people who haven't been a part of the scientific community might not necessarily understand the underpinnings and what these things mean. And it's easy to say, you know, like from a taxpayer's standpoint, like, I don't want to pay for that. But at the same time, this is how technology works. This is how the field works. So when we talk about funding for science declining over time, or in the case of the shutdown, you know, scientists kind of being held with the rest of these funding agencies, It's kind of hard not to get the message that the government is saying that science isn't essential, or science is a non-essential mm-hmm. appendage of the American, of the American system, the American way of life. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. We were talking a little bit earlier about some great examples of how science has helped the public, both through public funding and through private funding. There was an example about how penicillin was initially kind of brought to the fore, or how the production of penicillin mm-hmm. was brought to the fore. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I actually do not recall the lab off the top of my head that discovered penicillin. Shame on me.
Disc.
I know. But penicillin's potential was realized in an academic setting. And this was occurring, this was discovered during World War II, and the potential to deal with infections that, you know, these days we wouldn't even bat an eye at. You know, you could cut yourself, for example, if you were a soldier in a trench and you got swamp foot or something, or you mm-hmm. cut yourself on barbed wire, that could be a death sentence before penicillin. And the urgency to mass produce this this miracle drug, which it really was at the time, became immediately clear. And Pfizer ended up getting into a contract with this lab and took charge of the mass production, and they actually invented deep tank fermentation. I believe the story goes they repurposed an old brewery for this. But they essentially learned how to make very large volumes of penicillin by growing the bugs that make them very quickly. And just like that, we had our first mass producible antibiotic that could be, we now consider it a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed things immediately for the better. We could beat sicknesses that would be a death sentence in just a few decades ago.
Although I do want to point out that there was some research that came out last year suggesting that Neanderthals may have had knowledge of penicillin as a treatment for what was it? I think they found the jawbone of a juvenile male that had what looked to be an impacted molar.
Oh,
so I guess they found traces of penicillin. I don't know what part of what they were studying, but they found traces of it that weren't found in other jawbones, suggesting that he was being specifically treated.
Oh, interesting.
With this and with other kinds of herbs, and like willow is an example mm-hmm. of something that's known to have a compound.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a
precursor to aspirin.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a fun thing about medicine, right? A lot of the traditional, you know, kind of quackish medicines, there are plenty of quackish medicines, but a lot of the traditional, you know, Chinese medicines, medieval medicines and everything, they were based on essentially citizen science.
Yeah.
Observations of an effect over time, repeatedly. And then people were like, oh, I can use this to deal with this infection. And, you know, in the case of penicillin, maybe it would be letting your cheese get moldy and putting it on your cut.
That's such a wonderful
something
point.
Something as simple as that, but, you know, based on observations, we don't know why, but this makes the cut go away or get less worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I jump in on this for a second? Oh, sorry, Josh, go ahead.
No, Kevin, take it away.
Also, it's interesting, Kelly, you're categorizing like why certain departments are considered fundamental and certain are not. And Matt's example is a really good one to highlight this notion that I think a lot of us have but don't talk about much, which is that politics, especially in government in general, is mostly reactive and not very proactive. So there are a lot of things that we're likely to miss out on that is just considered, is sort of euphemized as mm-hmm. non-essential, right?
But
over the course of things, there are a lot of things that we consider essential now that we couldn't have foreseen back then to some degree, at least certainly in a politics that's entirely reactive.
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm. And especially if you want to talk about economic development as well, the value that science has to economics.
All the technology on the table.
Yeah. Did you have something? I'm sorry to cut you off. Did you have something that you wanted to throw in about public good and medicine?
Oh, the story of penicillin is well worth exploring because it was absolutely incredible how they developed. I mean, they were growing penicillin spores in universities on the floor during the war, and then they slowly worked it up. It's an incredible story, and it's insane. But yeah, I think what's so interesting, especially about that time...
Overly honest methods.
It really was. But hey, they had no idea what they were doing, which, you know, was part of the great brilliance of science, is it was this stepwise movement. But I think there's such an emphasis, too. What's really interesting is that, you know, penicillin was really, in many ways, a wartime development. This wasn't necessarily a public good. You know, a lot of really advanced science often came from military breaching, or, you know, working hand in hand with science. There's great examples of that. You know, the first sustained atomic reaction was done at Argonne National Labs, just outside of Chicago, which was a huge part of, you know, the development of the nuclear weapon and things like that. So, you know, there's good and bad alike. You know, now we think of nuclear reactions more as a commodity for energy. But all the amazing things, DARPA, we're talking about radar, it's absolutely incredible.
PET scans.
Exactly. A lot of this stuff really came out of these military developments. And now it's transitioned more into like a public commodity.
Yeah, and GPS too. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our precision weather data comes from government-funded agencies as well, which people might not know that kind of behind the scenes, that's also at work. You know, every time you use a GPS to navigate somewhere, you can thank federally funded science for not getting lost.
Decades later, we are still reaping the benefits from that.
Yeah, right? You're welcome. another one.
We were there back in the day.
Oh, yeah, for sure. yeah, on the come up.
And now it helps us hatch our Poca Go eggs. Isn't that just beautiful? Also saying Poca Go. Wow, that was horrible.
A little something for Poca Go. Been a long
but week. How about we talk about the Human Genome Project, because that is my personal favorite in terms of very obvious returns.
Did you want, we've got a fact sheet.
Yeah, we do. So
some specific information.
We wanted to highlight some specifics. So the Human Genome Project began in the late 90s, and I believe it was, a 10-year endeavor?
At the time, and there was some competition between whether or not it would be privately funded or whether it would be federally funded, and ultimately the federally funded research won out, but not without benefits for both parties. Mm-hmm. We can talk about Craig Venture some other time.
Oh, sure. Oh, he's certainly benefiting from the fruits of the federally funded research that went out here. But I think it's important before diving into this to emphasize just why public funded science is an important strategy for moving the field forward. The Human Genome Project, as most people know at this stage, was our nation's effort to sequence the entire human genome. And the goal was we would unlock all the secrets of genetics and medicine and be able to do heralded in a new age of precision medicine. The thing with that type of a project is it's so risky. Really, you cannot achieve something so risky and on such a scale with one or even several companies. The reason being, companies live and die by their bottom line. That's just a fact.
Right.
The advantage to government funding is it's taxpayer money. You can appropriate this funding. And there are plenty of arguments for and against taking money from taxpayers, for sure. But that said, you cannot make a project like this possible without the ability to scoop large amounts of public dollars and put in towards it.
And I will say also that, like, I don't know if you guys remember the fervor at the time, but it was a big part of the public imagination too, that we would be sequencing. It's, you know, for the same reason the nation united under going to the moon. It's one of these things where it really brings a lot of camaraderie and a lot of interest towards science and technology. You know, it's a dream that people had.
Sure. So, yeah, let's wind back to the late 90s. There was no complete published map of the genome. Now there's 23andMe.
Dark days indeed.
Now there is 23andMe. You can spend $80 on a box, a kit, and you can administer it to yourself, send it away, and you learn what's in your genes. That was not possible 15, even 10, maybe even 5 years ago. Not commercially, anyway.
Commercially, big point.
But since time is already running out, which is a bummer, but I'll highlight some economic statistics done by an independent research group that analyzed the economic returns of the Human Genome Project. And bear in mind, this is already outdated by 6 years. This report was released in 2013. So between 1988 and 2010, the real fervor of the project, federal investment in genomic research generated an economic impact of $796 billion. Between 1990 and 2003, spending for the Human Genome Project was $3.8 billion. So think about that. That's a 141-fold return on investment. For every dollar spent, $141 of economic development. That's jobs, that's new technology, that's entire biotech sectors.
Yeah.
Grew out of this just over the course of 10 years. In 2010 alone, genomics directly supported more than 51,000 jobs, indirectly supported more than 310,000 jobs. This created $20 billion in personal income and added $67 billion to the U.S. economy. This is not temporary. This is, the envelope is now pushed. So these benefits will continue to accrue because, as with any type of research endeavor, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We can now take technologies like this for granted, which will make future returns on research endeavors untold in their benefit.
Yeah, and the benefits are, they're increasing over time. I mean, certainly our jobs or our work is at least partially influenced by this project, you know, because of what we know about this data. I mean, it increased access to data, sharing of data. It did a lot to help the scientific community and especially the field of genetics move forward in terms of plant genetics. It affected that, and it affected so many things.
Well, like the idea of precision medicine going along with it, you know, as we all talk about, you know, cancer being such a primary disease, you know, precision medicine with cancer, targeting specific genes, or even designing medicines that you know are going to be more effective towards certain people versus other is absolutely incredible. And really, in many ways, the direction that medicine is going. And, you know, it's these little baby steps, something that seems so insignificant now that's so major.
Yeah. So in the last couple minutes, I do kind of want to just bring it back around to this initial question of why should the public care about federally funded research, you know, whether that goes away, how that's used in policy. And, you know, besides the current shutdown, I mean, that is what it is. But there's also this ongoing trend in a lot of ways to devalue evidence-based research in terms of policy decision. I know that you guys are a lot more involved in science policy than I am. So in the last couple of minutes, can you tell us just a little bit about how you feel about science policy and the way science is treated?
Yeah, science policy, I think, is really interesting because, I mean, science is just so fundamental. And oftentimes, rhetoric and politics can get in the way of a lot of these decisions, which is unfortunate, but it's true and doesn't get in the way of everything. But science is so informed. I would say it's the culture and value of science in many ways that can be so advantageous for science policy and using that policy and using science to develop said policy. You know, look at the changes in the environment, right? In many ways, we need that scientific advancement to direct that policy so that our future generations are going to be able to live on the same planet that we currently do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. And one of the toughest things about these policy changes is, as we've just glossed over, science works, and it works fantastically well when it's left alone and it's funded properly. This drift away from evidence, the appreciation of evidence-based science, is problematic in policy decisions in the future, notably climate science. It should not be a debate, but it's become politicized sufficiently to be that way.
I want to thank my guests, Josh and Matt, for joining me tonight. This has been the Perpetual Notion Machine. My name is Kelly Schwartz.